Hello and a very warm welcome to the first in a series of podcasts brought to you by the North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group, or NOSPRIG for short. My name is Julie Jones and I'm part of the NOSPRIG group, which is made up of volunteers, including people living with Parkinson's, those that have loved ones with Parkinson's, or healthcare professionals like me who have a huge interest in Parkinson's. What unites us all is we're passionate about the value of research and its role in informing how services are provided and in thinking about improving treatments for the Parkinson's community. Parkinson's UK supports a number of research interest groups throughout the United Kingdom, supported by the fantastic Liz Nash, who's the Research Support Network Manager, and her team. All the research interest groups, affectionately known as RIGs, share the common goal of sharing and shaping research within the sphere of Parkinson's. Getting people involved in research is challenging. During the pandemic, many RIGs conducted webinars and invited researchers to come and share their current and past research work with the wider Parkinson's community. Indeed, prior to COVID, many researchers invited the Parkinson's community into their research areas or their research labs to showcase their work and assist in breaking down some of the barriers associated with participating or being involved in research. However, due to the wide geographical areas covered by NOSPRIG, which extends from Stonehaven in the south all the way to the north of Scotland and includes the Windy Isles of Shetland and Orkney, we thought we needed to try something different. And hence this idea of a series of podcasts arose. So rather than inviting the Parkinson's community to meet the researcher, we thought we'd trial bringing the researchers to you. So we do hope you're going to enjoy this series of podcasts that we're bringing to you now. So, today I have the great pleasure of welcoming Dr. Angus McLeod to the podcast. Angus is a consultant neurologist within NHS Grampian, but he's also a senior clinical lecturer at Aberdeen University, conducting research into Parkinson's and other movement disorders. Angus is an epidemiologist, so he's interested in who gets Parkinson's and why they get Parkinson's. And his main interest within this field of Parkinson's is exploring prognostic factors associated with Parkinson's and his interest in developing prognostic models, which we're going to hear all about today. Angus has been involved in a number of high-impact national research studies and works closely with Dr. Carl Counsell, who will feature on a future podcast. So there's another one for you to look forward to. So, thank you, Angus, for joining us for the first of the series of podcasts and for kindly giving up your time. I have an extensive list of questions here to work through with you, which have been compiled from people living with Parkinson's in the Northeast. And this is the edited version. So it really just demonstrates, you know, the level of interest that there is from the Parkinson's community and the number of people out here there who are keen to get involved in research and really to engage with the research that's currently happening in the area of Parkinson's. So enough of me. Angus, I've only very briefly touched upon your research interest and your work to date. I wonder if you could expand on this and tell us what got you into research and a little bit more detail about your current work.
Okay, thanks, Julie. So that goes back to when I was a medical student and I was interested in neurology and I was looking for a research project to do. I got in touch with Carl Counsell, who suggested I do a project in Parkinson's disease, and I really enjoyed doing that, and as I got more experience in medicine and neurology in particular, I realised how fascinating a condition Parkinson's disease is. And there's so much variation between different people with Parkinson's. Everyone's different, and I'm sure those of you with Parkinson's and people who look after people with Parkinson's will find that how different they might be from other people with Parkinson's. I think that's a really interesting thing and a challenging thing about the condition. So Parkinson's is such an interesting condition, and I had opportunity to do more research in Parkinson's, and I enjoy doing that. And I guess one thing led to another, and that's how I'm here today.
Well, I can certainly agree with that. It's always a nice clinical challenge because no day is the same day and no patient's the same. So it's always something that keeps you on your toes.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. So with your current research activity, you know, how do you find that's influenced your clinical practice both here locally in the Northeast and perhaps further afield?
So that's a big question. Perhaps if I first of all talk a bit about what I do in terms of research. And so most of my research is in Parkinson's. My main interest in the epidemiology of Parkinson's, and that really, and more specifically, the prognosis in Parkinson's, so how Parkinson's affects people over time. A main part of what I do is developing something called prognostic models in Parkinson's disease. So prognostic models are tools that we can bring together characteristics of individuals with Parkinson's and use that to try to predict how people will do over time. And that can have lots of important benefits. We can use these models to help to give information to individuals about how they may be affected by the Parkinson's. And we can use that in research, lots of uses in research. And one thing is, one very useful aspect of these models is if we use them in the design of a clinical trial, we can make a clinical trial more efficient, which means that treatments can hopefully be brought to people with Parkinson's more quickly and at lower cost to the organisations that are funding the research. And the ultimate goal of using prognostic models is to lead to personalised treatment, where we can tailor individual treatment decisions to the characteristics of an individual with Parkinson's. That's really in its infancy in Parkinson's, and we probably need better prognostic models and perhaps even better treatments to be able to do that better in Parkinson's. But that's where I hope we will get to with research into prognostic models in Parkinson's disease. The part of your question about the clinical impact and how I would like my research to have much more clinical impact than it does. I think we're still working we're still doing a lot of work about prognosis and developing prognostic models. So I think a lot of that is still to come. One example of research that's been useful clinically and has changed clinical practice goes back to something I did in the very early days of my research career. So when I was a medical student, I did a systematic review looking at particular type of drugs that are used in Parkinson's disease and trying to evaluate, bring together all the research that had been done into whether these drugs were effective or not, and summarising that research. The group of drugs we looked at was called monoamine oxidase type B inhibitor. So selegiline was the main drug that was around back then, though many of you will have heard of risagiline, which is the newer version of that drug. And we found something that wasn't apparent in the individual clinical trials of these drugs, but when we pulled the data together from several trials, that these drugs probably have a role in delaying the onset of one of the important complications of the use of levodopa in Parkinson's disease. So many people with levodopa treatment for their Parkinson's will develop something called motor fluctuation. So the effectiveness of the drugs that they use for Parkinson's will wear off, and they'll notice they become slower or stiffer or shakier coming up to the time the next dose of medication is due. But these drugs seem to delay the development of this problem. So particularly in younger patients with Parkinson's, I would often start these drugs early on in order to delay these complications in the long run. So that's just one example of where research has influenced clinical practice. And that systematic review has been quoted in many important guidelines.
So it's interesting to see that not only just does primary research have an impact in clinical practice, but also that when you engage with research and summarising all those findings, that bringing together several studies all together can hugely impact on clinical practice.
Yes, that's absolutely correct, and I think we should be encourage the data that people give when they enrol in research studies as widely as possible. And so often participants might be recruited into a specific study, but the data from that study could be used for many other purposes as well. So make the best use as we can out of any individual's participation in research.
Yeah, that's super. So thinking about research in general, what in your opinion do you think is the most exciting areas of research currently being explored, either here locally or further afield? What sort of things are you particularly interested in?
So that's a big question. There's lots of exciting and interesting things being done in the field of Parkinson's disease. I can give you some examples. I'm not saying they're necessarily the only examples I could give. I've talked a lot about developing prognostic models, and I think that I really hope that will be very useful in improving the way we look after people with Parkinson's in the long term. So I think that's something that I think is very useful, and I do believe will make a difference to people's lives with Parkinson's disease. At the moment, in the national level, there's lots of clinical trials going on for people with Parkinson's to try and assess whether new treatments do work for people with Parkinson's. Clearly, there's many aspects of Parkinson's we don't have good treatments for. One trial that I'm involved with is the Chief PD study, which is a trial to try and identify a new treatment for falls in Parkinson's. So at the moment, we don't have good treatments for falls and Parkinson's. And this is a trial of a drug called rivastigmine, which we already use for other things in Parkinson's. So we know it's safe, and we've got a lot of experience of using it already. And we're looking to see whether people who are falling with Parkinson's, if they take this drug, they will have a reduction in the number of falls or even have their falls prevented altogether. So I think these sorts of trials, particularly of drugs that are already established, are really exciting. And if these drugs are already known to be safe, that means that they can be brought into clinical use much more quickly than many new drugs. So I think that's something that's really interesting. Talking internationally, there's a lot of stuff going on. One thing I think is interesting is research into stem cells and Parkinson's disease. It's something that has been used really in research for about 30 years now, and we still don't have a treatment for people with Parkinson's that's known to be effective and that's available based on stem cells. And there's a new type of stem cells called induced stem cells, which can be derived from people's skin. That avoids the problems with using embryo or fetal stem cells. And there's trials going on to see if implanting these stem cells into the brain can generate new dopamine-producing cells in the brain and thereby treat or even cure some of the aspects of Parkinson's disease. We're expecting some results of these trials to be available in the next couple of years. These trials so far are still small, and I think really this sort of technology is not yet ready to be used more widely, but it's an interesting thing, and hopefully it will be something that's useful for people with Parkinson's in coming years.
You mentioned the Chief PD study, which you're currently recruiting for. Is there any other opportunities happening here in the Northeast where people could get involved in research?
So most of what I do at the moment is with data that's already collected. But I've mentioned the Chief PD study. There's another trial that's we're recruiting for people with hallucinations and Parkinson's. And there are definitely more clinical trials that will be coming up in the near future. I have also plans to recruit to other studies, what we call observational studies, so not treatment trials. These aren't ready to go quite yet, so that'll be in the future. So there will, I'm sure, be lots of opportunities to be involved with research in the longer term.
Super. So part of it with the research interest group, people are really interested to hear about what the current research findings are, which you've shared some of your work to date. I think the other thing is that one thing we're trying to do in conjunction with Parkinson's UK is increase the number of people who get involved in research, because really the quality of research and research output and these findings which impact on clinical practice are dependent on people taking part in research. I wonder if you could just talk us through from your perspective, what exactly is involved in participating in an academic study?
Okay, so that's a good question. It very much depends on what the individual study is. So there's a variety of studies. So I mentioned the treatment trials that involves being randomised, randomly allocated to either a treatment or a placebo version of the treatment. And in that situation, you wouldn't normally know which you were getting. But as part of that study, there's usually lots of assessments with various questionnaires and a clinical examination and some walking tests and measurements of blood pressure and heart tracing. There's a whole variety of things that may be done as part of that research study. And there's pros and cons of collecting so much data. One advantage is that that data could be used to answer other questions, other research questions that we might have. As well as trying to work out whether that particular treatment in the trial is effective, we can look at other aspects of Parkinson's as well. But the more there is to be done for a particular study, the more onerous it is, and the more difficult it is for people to participate in the study. And that can be a problem, particularly when Parkinson's becomes more advanced and causes more problems. It may be more difficult for people to be involved in studies. But other studies are much simpler, and some studies might involve just a single appointment to do a small number of questionnaires. Other studies can be done just looking at medical records with data that's collected routinely as part of normal clinic visits. So there's a variety of things to get involved. So I think the important thing to say is that for any research study, it's important to be fully informed of what the study involves, and any researcher will give you information about the study, what is involved, and will give you opportunities to answer questions. So if you're not sure what a study would involve but are interested to be involved in research, you just need to ask the questions, and we will all be very happy to help you and inform you and talk you through what is involved.
And I think that's something that's reassuring, isn't it? So the information that you're given, you can always have that opportunity to discuss the pros and cons, and in the end it's entirely up to you as an individual whether you wish to participate.
Well, exactly. No one's compelled to be involved in research. I would like to see a situation in the northeast, or perhaps even more widely in Scotland, where everybody with Parkinson's gets involved in research in some way or another. And some people would want to be very heavily involved in research. Other people might want to be minimally involved in research. But there's so much data that we gather when people come to hospital clinics, it seems a shame not to use that data. And I think we should have conversations with people with Parkinson's and with Parkinson's UK and other organisations to talk about how that could be done in practice. Obviously, there's privacy concerns, and all data would have to be stored and analysed in a confidential way. But that is routinely done in research, so that I don't think these things are an obstacle to moving to that sort of way of doing things. But in the ideal world, I think everyone would be involved in research.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be really valuable if that's something that people can be involved in right from the outset. I've got a question here that's been posed by somebody from the Parkinson's community, just in relation to the design and methodology of clinical trials. And it often can be in a clinical trial that you only have 10% of the patients perhaps have a positive result, if it was looking at a drug trial. But unfortunately, that positivity can often be lost in the overall results. And therefore, the conclusion may very well be drawn that the treatment was ineffective. And I suppose their question they really want to ask is, how can we work to get targeted treatments for people with Parkinson's that will benefit from that, and perhaps look at subtyping so we can look at ensuring perhaps individual groups of Parkinson's community could benefit from this?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's also quite a difficult question to answer. It's very difficult to prove that a treatment works for a specific group of people. So many trials where some people get benefit and some don't, that's just the play of chance, and it doesn't mean that there's a clinically useful benefit from the treatment for some people. But in other cases, it does. But it's difficult to prove that statistically, because you generally need quite large numbers to prove that something is a real benefit and not due to chance. So one way to do that is to work out what characteristics would indicate or would be associated with a benefit, and do another trial just in that group of people. But that involves the various costs and the time taken to do another clinical trial, so it's not ideal. I think one way we can do this better is using prognostic models. I mentioned prognostic models can make trials more efficient. With prognostic models, you could get groups of people that were different levels of prognosis or different levels of severity. So people with milder disease and moderate disease and more severe disease, for instance. And you could decide in the trial that you're going to look at these people separately. And that would be a more robust way to try and identify who's a responder, who's not a responder to a particular treatment. So there are ways to do this. It's really a lot more difficult to do this with a subgroup of patients with Parkinson's rather than the population of Parkinson's as a whole. It's a really important question. It's a difficult thing to demonstrate definitively and objectively, but it's where we need to go. We need better personalised treatment for people with Parkinson's. I'm sure you, Julia, and everyone who's listening appreciate that. A lot of our treatments at the moment are very generic. It's the same for everybody. And if we could tailor things better, we would hopefully have better outcomes in people with Parkinson's. So it's definitely an important area, and it's an area I'm interested in. But there are definitely challenges here that are not always easy to overcome.
But it certainly highlights the need for what your work is looking at in terms of prognostic modelling. We need to be able to look at confident subtypes of Parkinson's, which then we can then look at whether those different groups will respond well to medication.
Yeah, I meant to pick up on the subtypes thing. There's been a lot of work looking at subtypes, and it's quite difficult to demonstrate subtypes. My personal view is that Parkinson's is more of a continuum or perhaps multidimensional continua, that discrete subtypes may not be easy to define. There's just so much variability between people with Parkinson's. There have been several studies looking at subtypes, and many of them found very different answers looking at the same question. So there are challenges here. Some of the more recent work has been replicated. So there are some broad subtypes I think we can identify. But my feeling is that trying to identify subtypes is probably the wrong question. We should be trying to tailor things more individually with prognostic models. So looking at several different factors together rather than identifying three or four broad subtypes.
So really quite a big area that we need to look at. And I'm sure we all understand that when we see the Parkinson's community and we're sitting, at our various meetings, everybody is so different. So, it's even thinking about what factors should be considered in a prognostic model. That is a challenge in itself.
Quite. And I think that is a good question. One reason I want to do more research and collect more data is that we don't necessarily have the right characteristics at the moment. So that is something that needs more research.
Staying on the line of research, somebody has put in a question. They'd obviously recently read a paper published in the Lancet, which really looked at the potential of using apomorphine and whether it would have an improvement on insomnia, particularly in Parkinson's. So what are your thoughts, particularly, in relation to this research and some of the challenges that this research sort of shows?
That's a great question. It's a very interesting study that was published recently in Lancet Neurology, looking at apomorphine for helping people with insomnia. So sleep problems are a common problem in Parkinson's and can be a very disabling problem with Parkinson's. And a problem we really don't have great treatments for. There's various things we can try for treating insomnia in Parkinson's, but we really do need better treatments for it. Apomorphine is something that's been used for many years in Parkinson's, usually just for people with advanced Parkinson's disease who have severe complications arising from the use of levodopa in Parkinson's. And it's a dopamine agonist, so it's the same type of drug as Rapinrol or Pramipexol or Retigotine, which many listeners will be aware of. The apomorphine is given as a subcutaneous injection, so an injection with a needle under the skin. So it's not as straightforward as just taking a tablet. So it's a much more complicated and indeed much more expensive treatment than the other treatments we use, most of the other treatments we use in Parkinson's disease. But it's a very interesting question. Should we be using it for sleep problems? I think there are some caveats that have to be mentioned relating to the particular study. So it was a very small study. There were 25 participants There were 50 participants split up into two groups, and they had an interesting design where they crossed over. So each participant had a period of time on apomorphine and a period of time on a placebo infusion to try and check their sleep. Partly because it was a small group of people with Parkinson's that were included in this study, the results aren't as clear cut as I would have liked them to be. So the questionnaire based measures of sleep were just reached the threshold for being statistically significant, and the more objective measures based on measurement of sleep from brainwave tracings did not seem to indicate that apomorphine had a benefit in terms of sleep. So there's a big question in my mind whether it actually does help sleep. And one potential reason why it would help with the subjective subjective measures of sleep based on questionnaires is that it's difficult to give a good placebo for apomorphine because of the other effects it has. So people would often feel the benefit of apomorphine, and I suspect many participants at least would have known that whether they were on the apomorphine or on the placebo. So there may be a placebo effect that was seen more in the subjective rather than the objective measures of sleep. So I think before we even consider using it for sleep, the study needs to be replicated in a larger sample of people with Parkinson's to see if it really does help with sleep. And if it does, I don't think I would generally be using it in people with mild Parkinson's disease who don't need apomorphine for other reasons. But there may be the occasional patient who is just severely disabled by poor sleep that I would consider using it. But I do think we need more data on that first.
Yeah, 25 people is a very small sample, especially when you're saying the statistics were statistically significant, but only, you know, just. So that's some further work that needs done to see whether those trends and results can be replicated. On a similar theme, in relation to the use of apomorphine, there's also a question here that, you know, does apomorphine present with similar risk in relation to impulse control problems as other dopamine agonists in that sort of family of medications?
Dopamine agonists are important treatments for Parkinson's disease. I'm often quite reluctant to use them because of the big concern about impulse control disorders. So impulse control disorders are a problem where people can't control their impulses properly. So we all have impulses to do slightly silly things, and our brain tells us, just don't do that, or just don't say that, or whatever. So sometimes people taking drugs for Parkinson's disease struggle to control these impulses, and it can lead people to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do, like start gambling or develop problematic gambling. People might spend too much money, not be able to control their spending. Some people have difficulty controlling their sex drive, which can lead to big problems as well. So these are the sorts of things you can get with impulse control disorders. It's relatively common in the class of drug known as dopamine agonists, but it's less problematic with apomorphine than with the other dopamine agonists. So they have been used successfully in people who couldn't use other dopamine agonists because of impulse control disorders, but it would certainly be something I would want to monitor quite closely if someone had problems with impulse control disorders before.
One of your other research interests that you mentioned, Angus, was in relation to nutrition. And certainly I'm interested to hear, this is a question I commonly get asked in clinical practice. I suppose, is there any recommendations you could give in respect to diet or nutrition and what people should be eating or not eating that have Parkinson's? What are your thoughts? $1 million question.
So nutrition's an interesting area in Parkinson's, and I came to this looking at weight loss in Parkinson's. So we quite often see that people with Parkinson's lose weight, and we don't really know why that is. And we found that weight loss was relatively common in the PINE study here in Aberdeen, which is a cohort study of people with Parkinson's who are followed up long term. And those who lost weight early on in the course of their illness had poorer long-term outcomes. So that's an interesting finding, and it actually resembles similar findings that have been identified in other neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease and Huntington's disease. So it does seem to be something that's associated with the neurodegeneration, not necessarily something specific to Parkinson's disease itself. We need to do a lot more work to see if there's anything can be done to reverse this weight loss and hopefully avoid these poorer long-term outcomes. But in the meantime, I don't have anything specific to say about diet. I think it's important that people eat a healthy diet, a balanced diet. So my advice to somebody with Parkinson's wouldn't be any different from my advice to anyone else. Eat a healthy, balanced diet. Make sure you have plenty of fruit and vegetables. Don't eat too much sugary foods and that sort of thing. So being generally healthy with a healthy diet, there are no specific foodstuffs that have been proven to be helpful or disadvantageous in people with Parkinson's.
There we go. A little bit of what you fancy and a little bit in moderation seems to be the way forwards.
That's a good way to put it.
Super. So I think really, just to wrap up today, the final question, we've talked a lot about research today and the need for people to participate in research and the value that research brings and how it can influence clinical practice and shape how the services you access are run and delivered. I suppose all this research is entirely dependent on people participating in research and very kindly and very generously giving up their time. I suppose just to finish, what do you perceive, Angus, do you think are the advantages for people living with Parkinson's and indeed their families to volunteer as part of the research, perhaps from your perspective as a researcher, but maybe from your experience of working with people with Parkinson's, what advantages they've found for themselves?
Yeah, so that's another great question, Julie. What I say to people with Parkinson's who are interested in research is that I can't promise them any individual benefits from participating in the research, but that we hope will advance knowledge for them and for other people with Parkinson's disease. So to a large extent, participation in research is altruistic. It's really primarily, at least, to benefit others rather than the individual that's participating in research. Obviously, there may be results of the research that's directly beneficial to the individual who's participating, so that they would benefit from them in the same way someone else might benefit from that research. But I do think there are other benefits from participating in research. We know in general, not in Parkinson's specifically, in general, people who participate in research have better health outcomes in general. And there's probably various reasons for that. Perhaps seeing health professionals more frequently as part of that. Perhaps it's a more motivated group of people that are involving themselves in research. But we do know that people involving research do have better outcomes overall, and there's probably a variety of other reasons for that as well. So I think it's a good thing, not just for people in general with Parkinson's, but I think it's a good thing for individuals as well to get involved with research. And there's something quite satisfying about trying to help other people through research. So I very much value people getting involved in research. I think it's useful for whatever my pet project might be at the time, but there are often wider benefits to people with Parkinson's as a whole or as a group of people, as well as to the individuals participating in the research. So I'd encourage as many people who are listening to this as possible to get involved in research, and I hope you'll find it a rewarding experience to do so.
And we discussed today, your participation may vary depending on the study design. So if it's an observational study or if it's a study that just requires you to complete a questionnaire, to some studies which may require you to be scanned or have blood tests. So different studies will have different requirements for participants. So it's about finding out the right study or a study that you're happy to be involved in.
Well, exactly. And I might say, we were talking about the studies we're recruiting to earlier, and I omitted to say there's another study that I'm recruiting patients for in conjunction with researchers in Dundee, which involves computer simulation. So essentially playing computer games to evaluate your decision-making ability. And that study also involves an MRI scan as well. So that's just a one-off visit for an hour, playing some computer games and followed up by an MRI scan. So very much there's different levels of involvement.
And even probably now that people can be involved right at the beginning of a research process and can be involved in the shaping of a research project, because I think that's something that's valuable, make sure that all the resources that are being developed by researchers are in a format that's understandable to the research community, the Parkinson's community. So you can be involved in the help of the design and development of a research project to also being a participant and all stops in between. So I suppose there's lots of opportunities to be involved in research.
Yeah, that's a great point, Julie. It's an important point. I think studies which involve people with Parkinson's in the design of the study will be much better studies than people that don't. And I said to you I was planning future studies, and I think it would be great to have a conversation at some stage with the research interest group about how best we take some of these ideas forward.
Oh, I'm sure they're a very eager group. I'm sure they'd like to be involved. So I think we'll stop there today. We didn't think we'd manage to fill the time, but we've managed to fill the time easily. So a huge thank you for your time today, Angus. It's been lovely talking with you.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Julie.